Folks, there are only 4 weeks left in 2013, and we're $64,000 short of making budget this year. Please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You could also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old, the pines were roaring on the height, the winds were in the night, the fire was red, it flaming spread, the trees like torches blazed with light.
I cannot guarantee his safety.
Understood.
Nor will I be responsible for his fate.
A tale or two to tell when you come back.
Can you promise that I will come back?
No. And if you do, you will not be the same.
My name is Bilbo Baggins.
Bagginses. What is a Bagginses? Precious.
The trailer from the first Hobbit movie, An Unexpected Journey, its sequel comes out next week, The Desolation of Smaug. We thought it'd be a good idea to go back before that long movie comes out that picks up where the first one left off and talk about the first one a little bit, in particular, since it's come out in an extended version that apparently has some very interesting religious symbolism to observe. Joining us to talk about the book and the movie, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, Pastor Ted Giese. He has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's associate pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and he's a regular contributor to the Canadian Lutheran Magazine. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
First of all, should we be looking for religious symbolism in the Hobbit books and films?
I think that it's perfectly fine to look for religious symbolism in there. I think the reason for that is that Tolkien, even though he wasn't setting out to write a Christian book, he was a devout Roman Catholic, so it was everything that he was doing had his faith kind of just coming out through it. So in a very real way, his vocation as, you know, university professor, writer, in that vocation, his Christian faith was going out in all that he was doing. So it just shows up. It's like the air that he breathes. As a result, there's going to be things in these books, this book, The Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings and other books of his, that will have Christian symbolism in it. What he didn't like was allegory, and allegory is very specific, and symbolism is a little more open to interpretation, so you can have maybe more going on in terms of symbolism in his books, and he would dislike allegory because it's so specific. Now, it seems like Peter Jackson, who's making these movies, who made the Lord of the Rings movies and is now making the Hobbit movies, the three of them that are coming out, he seems to be more interested in allegory. So he seems to push more in the direction of allegory than Tolkien might like. But in either case, whether allegory or symbolism, you're still going to have it be, it seems to be coming very strongly across that it's Christian allegory and symbolism that's going on underneath the hood of the Hobbit.
For those who aren't familiar with it, maybe haven't read the books or seen the films, give us the thumbnail sketch of the story that the Hobbit book and the films are telling.
The Hobbit book is kind of a classic three-act story, and that's why they've ended up turning it into three films. So it starts off with Bilbo Baggins, who is the central protagonist, and he gets pulled along on this adventure. He goes to help out these dwarves who have had their mountain kingdom taken over by a dragon. So the goal is to get to the mountain and get rid of the dragon and get the dwarves back what they'd lost. That's the general thing. When Tolkien wrote it, he didn't anticipate writing the Lord of the Rings books. Those books didn't get written until 17 years after The Hobbit. So, in fact, later he went back and changed a couple things in the book The Hobbit to fit better in with the Lord of the Rings. One thing that he did is he made some changes to the ring that is the central part of the story in the Lord of the Rings, and you're introduced to that ring in the movie The Hobbit.
So, there was an interview many years ago when J.R.R. Tolkien was still alive, in which he was being asked a kind of a variety of questions about the Hobbit book, and he was answering them. One of the questions he was asked was whether or not he intended the various peoples that populate Middle-earth, the world of the Hobbit, to stand for any peoples in current history. Here's what he had to say, and I'd like your reaction to it.
Before we make the elves immortal in a sense, I have to use immortal, but I didn't mean that they were eternally immortal, but merely that they are very longevable, and their longevity probably lasts as long as the inhabitability of the earth. The dwarves, of course, quite obviously, couldn't you say in many ways they remind you of the Jews? All their words are Semitic, obviously, constructed be Semitic. The hobbits are just rustic English people, made small in size because it reflects the general small reach of their imagination, but not the small reach of their courage or latent power.
Pastor Giese, why do you think what Tolkien said there is important, especially what he said with respect to the dwarves in the Hobbit story and their parallels with the Jews?
I think for the Christian viewer who goes to see the movie The Hobbit, when you know that Tolkien thought that about the dwarves years later, it just unlocks a number of possibilities. And then it seems as though Peter Jackson is picking up on this. And now he's surrounded himself with Tolkien scholars and all sorts of individuals who have really pored over all of these things, including letters that Tolkien wrote to people. And what this does when you see Tolkien himself making the connection between the dwarves in the film and Jews, for the Christian viewer, holy crow, you get things like Thorin, Oakenshield, the main dwarf, who wants to be the king under the mountain, whose birthright it is to do that. He of course has with him 12 other dwarves taken out of the dwarvish people who come with him on this adventure. Well, you know, they're discussing all of their plans at a table at the beginning of this first film, and all of a sudden you go, oh well, there's like Jesus and the 12 disciples, or maybe there's like Joshua and the 12 tribes of Israel there who are going to claim their homeland. And then when you think of the other stuff that's going on in the prologue of this film, Jackson uses terms that are loaded for a Christian ear to hear when you hear Bilbo Baggins saying about how the dwarves were robbed of their homeland and they were left to be wandering in the wilderness. All of a sudden, you get images of the exile or the Exodus. And this is where understanding it maybe more as symbolism is better than allegory, because it's hard to pin down a character like Thorin Oakenshield as allegorical. He doesn't stand in the place of a single person from Scripture. So, you know, you have elements in him of Joshua, elements in him of Jesus, elements of Ezra, you know, the one who keeps the Torah in front of people's eyes when they return from the exile, and who helps rebuild the temple, or a character like Nehemiah who wants to and then ends up rebuilding the walls, because one of the things that Thorin Oakenshield wants to do is he wants to go back and reclaim the Lonely Mountain and bring it back to its former glory because it's been destroyed. So this is very interesting to the Christian who might be watching this movie.
In the extended version of the first movie, An Unexpected Journey, that has come out in advance of the second installation that Peter Jackson has produced, The Desolation of Smog, you say in that extended version, you really see a lot of what's going on in the mind of the filmmaker, at least, on how he wants to tell this story, maybe even if it isn't how Tolkien necessarily wanted to tell the story. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you go out and buy this Blu-ray, or you get it, a DVD of it or something like that, the actual extra footage in the movie, it's like another 15 minutes in the movie itself, that just helps with the pacing of the movie and makes it a more enjoyable watch. But when you look at the special features and the commentary and you hear all of what they're doing to produce this film, that's where you start to see the thought processes going on in the filmmaker, and you start to see what he's doing with telling the story. So in a way, him telling this story, there are things that work in books and there are things that work in movies, and he's going for the things that work in movies. And in Western culture, in North America, they're making these in New Zealand, but they're still kind of connected to the way we make movies in North America. There's certain Christian capital that exists just in the underpinnings of how you tell stories in film. And he seems to be pulling some of that stuff in. And then by doing that, you get additional Christian symbolism and allegory kind of popping up in this. So, for instance, they need a strong antagonist to their protagonist, one of the protagonists that they're developing, which is Thorin Oakenshield. So the antagonist that they're developing is this villain, Azog. Well, Azog doesn't show up in The Hobbit. I think he's in a footnote once because his son shows up later, and that would happen in the third movie of these three films. But they pluck him out of other writings from Tolkien, and they put him in there in a very real sense. Like he's a long since dead character in Tolkien's world, but in Peter Jackson's telling of this story, he's alive and well, and he is a fierce antagonist to Thorin Oakenshield, the protagonist of this first film. So like Thorin Oakenshield and Bilbo Baggins are like co-protagonists for this film, and this Azog becomes this big villain. Well, Azog, he is like a foil to Thorin Oakenshield. He, you know, if you look at it from the point of view of a Christian, you know, you're watching this, and they're almost two sides of the same coin. Both people have been slighted in the past, and both people want to have vengeance, and they're running headlong into each other. So there's, you know, Thorin Oakenshield wants to get to his mountain, but Azog wants to just destroy all of the dwarves and wipe them off the face of the earth. So when you're watching this, he comes across, you know, as this kind of, I don't know, almost, you know, he's referred to as the pale orc, which they do in the book too, but somehow it comes across like his desire to wipe off all of the dwarves from the earth, and particularly this line of Durin, kind of comes across almost like a Nazi kind of thing.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the book and the movie The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, in advance of the second movie's release next week. Pastor Ted Giese is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Thankful for God's service through the pastors in your life? Then consider attending Christ for Us in the Office of the Holy Ministry, a conference of the Association of Confessing Evangelical Lutheran Congregations, this coming February 25th through 27th in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Visit our website at acelc.net for information on Christ for Us in the Office of the Ministry. Register online at acelc.net.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe the traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.
If Issues Etc. refuses to scratch your itchy ears and scratches your old scabs instead, and you love them for it, then Redeemer Lutheran Church is the church in Fort Wayne for you. The only real difference between Issues Etc. and Redeemer is that Todd and Jeff only talk about Jesus. We talk about Jesus, but we also put him into people's mouths. We drive off demons with water. We are the church, and yes, we serve Jell-O in the basement.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Grace Lutheran, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Heritage Lutheran, Valparaiso, Indiana. Mount Olive Lutheran, Duluth, Minnesota. Our Savior's Lutheran, Windham, Minnesota. St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. St. John Lutheran, Yuma, Colorado. Christ Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri, and Redeemer Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.
At break of day, to find our long forgotten gold, the pines were roaring.
We're talking about the movie The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Pastor Ted Giese is our guest. When was Jesus really born? You'd think that since his birth is so well attested to in historical sources, including the New Testament and many thereafter, that we'd know the date. We'd be able to put our finger down on the calendar and say right here, right at this place on this day. Well, his date, the date of his birth can be determined, but it's not a very easy question to answer. It's rather complex, but it can be answered. And determining the date of Jesus' birth also answers a lot of other historical questions with respect to his life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension. That's the subject of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December. When was Jesus really born? Early Christianity, the calendar, and the life of Jesus. You can find out more about this book by calling Concordia Publishing House and ordering one. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December. When was Jesus really born? Pastor Giese, a couple of the questions, things that you point out about the character of Thorin Oakenshield in the Hobbit books and films is you say that Peter Jackson kind of not only makes him kind of younger, sprier, also makes him a little less filled with avarice. Tolkien makes him out to be obsessed with gold and with the greed of recapturing the wealth of his people. But that's not the picture you get of this guy in the Peter Jackson movies, at least not initially.
Not in this first one. And that is dialed way, way, way back in this. And I think the reason is that they want to have this kind of long character arc for him. He is going to get there. By the time you get to the third movie, it's going to be seeped right into him. So almost like you see Frodo in the Lord of the Rings movies, getting more and more corrupted by the ring, I think that you're going to see that happening to Thorin Oakenshield as he gets closer and closer to his goal. They've definitely, in this first movie, really taken a lot of that out. But in the second film, you're going to see that as he's getting closer to the mountain is going to be when that starts coming out.
The character of Bilbo, much could be said of him. But what do you want to say with respect to what we heard before from Tolkien himself, talking about the dwarves as parallels to the Jews of his day? Does the Bilbo character, as it's portrayed in the book and films, does it reinforce that idea?
In the book, not as much. But in the films, it seems to, because Peter Jackson included some scenes in the movie that aren't in the book. So one of the themes that they're developing for Bilbo Baggins in the first film is him belonging to this group of dwarves, being part of this company. So that's his little character arc for this first film. How does he deserve his role of being part of this group, not just signing your name on a piece of paper, but actually living out this life with these guys on the road? So you get this point at which Bilbo Baggins wants to leave and take off, because he loves his armchair and his books and his garden, and he loves being at home. And one of the dwarves, Beaufort, ends up seeing him about to leave, and he says, you can't go back now. You're part of the company. You're one of us. And he says, I'm not one of you. And then through that conversation, he ends up kind of, you know, regretting something that he says. And he says, you know, that the dwarves, they're used to this kind of life of being on the road, never settling in one place, not belonging anywhere. And as soon as he says that, of course, the dwarf becomes crestfallen and he's all upset. And he says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. But it really, that scene is not in the book, but it's in the movie. And Jackson is putting it there to tell something of this story, and it seems to connect more with the Jewish kind of idea almost that's put on these dwarves. And the second beat of that comes later on, because after they get through a bunch of scrapes and they're kind of at the end of the movie, you get this conversation. They figure that Bilbo is gone and that he's run away or he's dead or something, and then they see him there, he's there, and Thorin Oakenshield says, forgive me for doubting you, and Bilbo Baggins says, no, it's fine, I would have doubted me too. And then Thorin presses, he wants to know why he came back. And Bilbo says, look, I know you doubt me, I know you always have, and you're right. I often think of Bag End, I miss my books, my armchair, my garden. See, that's where I belong, at home. That's why I came back, because you don't have one, a home. It was taken from you, but I will help you take it back if I can. So it's really reinforcing this idea of returning from exile or making a conquest of this promised land that has been taken away from them. And those are additional scenes that are in the film, but they're not in the book. So, and I know that Jackson has had, and his writers have had all sorts of, you know, contact with Tolkien's other writings, and they know about all of his thoughts on these matters. And it does seem like he's going in that direction. Now, I listened very carefully to everything on the extended version of this film, and looking for the smoking gun where they say exactly that, and it isn't there. But they also didn't have a special feature just on the way they're writing it. So you have to pick bits and pieces of things along the way to kind of get a feel for what they're doing. But they do know exactly what they're doing. When they make major changes to the way the story unfolds in the book, they know that they are. It's not expedience or some other reason, you know, budgetary reasons. They're making the decision because they want to tell a good story on film, and because of that they're using some film conventions and things that you know, even maybe Christian Capital is in the back of their mind, and it's popping out in the work. In the next two films, there's going to be extended versions of each of those. I'm sure at some point they're going to have a thing where they talk about the writing, because one of the things that happened when they came out and said they were making these movies, they said they're making two. And now they've said they're making three. And they had to make decisions about that with the writing. Why would they decide to make two films? Why would they decide to make three films? They're going to talk about how they broke things up and their philosophy in writing. So I'm very looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to this movie that's coming out on the 13th. I think it's going to be fantastic. I look forward to coming back and talking about that. It's being told in a leisurely way. They're not. This is not an abridgment of the story. In fact, they know that they can't do some of these other things that Tolkien writes, but they want to bring some of that into these movies because this is their last kick at the can, these three movies. This is their last time in Middle-earth, and when they get out the other end of this, that's all that they're going to have.
So with about a minute here, it sounds like what you're saying is to, if I could, you know, take the liberty of saying that Peter Jackson has thoroughly immersed himself in the mindset of the author of the book, J.R.R. Tolkien, and taking these liberties as a filmmaker, not just to move the story along, but to try and reflect, it, perhaps, if I could be so bold, if J.R.R. Tolkien were making this film, this is what he would include and how he would do it, given his beliefs.
I think that's a good way of putting it, and I think the other part is that he wants to make it connect with the Lord of the Rings movies that he's already made. And Tolkien himself, you know, didn't have a chance to make it all fit together just the way he would have liked. You know, so in a way, he has access to other notes and things that Tolkien wrote. And I don't know how, you know, all of the stuff happening in the background, like, you know, Peter Jackson knows. I'd love to ask him. But I think that's what's going on. I think that there is a desire to make this, all of six of these movies in the end, really fit well together. You know, like the Star Wars movies that came out, when they were making those, they weren't just, like they made the prequels, they weren't just wrecking the movies in these prequels they were making. They were also wrecking the movies they'd made before it. And Jackson doesn't want that. Like, he wants all of this stuff to fit together and make sense as six movies that all work together to tell this story that Tolkien had, and to make it all kind of come together.
Pastor Ted Giese has a bachelor's degree in fine arts. He's associate pastor of Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and he's a regular contributor to the Canadian Lutheran Magazine. Ted, thank you very much, and I do look forward to our conversation on the next Hobbit movie as soon as we can get you back on.
Excellent. Me too. Thanks.
When we come back, Dr. Jennifer Oback Morse is going to join us. There's an interesting story out of Mississippi, I believe. You might have read about it. A couple that was married, a same-sex couple, is married in San Francisco, live in Mississippi. They want a divorce, and they want the state of Mississippi to recognize their marriage and their divorce. We'll sort that out with Dr. Jennifer Oback Morse after this. I have a ball just like we always do. Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture we see?
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. 618-670-6952.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.